Since the beginning of the Republic, few debates have been as hotly contested as the one over executive versus legislative powers. At the Constitutional Convention, the founders sought to create a strong executive but check in powers. They left those powers sufficiently ambiguous so that room was left for Congress and the President to struggle over the direction of the nation's security and foreign policies. The most serious question has centered on whether or not the President needs congressional authorization to wage war. The current status of that debate seems to have settled into a recognition that a president can deploy military forces for small and limited operations, but needs at least congressional support, if not explicit authorization, for large and more open-ended military operations. This calculus becomes important in this story, as both President Clinton and President Bush chose not to seek a declaration of war on bin Laden after he'd declared and begun to wage war on us, a declaration that they did not acknowledge publicly. Not until after 9/11 was a congressional authorization sought. The most substantial change in national security oversight in Congress took place following World War II. The Congressional Reorganization Act of 1946 created the modern Armed Services Committees that have become so powerful today. One especially noteworthy innovation was the creation of the Joint House-Senate Atomic Energy Committee, which is credited by many with the development of our nuclear deterrent capability, and was also criticized for wielding too much power relative to the executive branch. Ironically, this committee was eliminated in the 1970s, as Congress was undertaking the next most important reform of oversight in response to the Church and Pike investigations into abuses of power. In 1977, the House and Senate created select committees to exercise oversight of the executive branch's conduct of intelligence operations. The Intelligence Committees. The House and Senate Select Committees on Intelligence share some important characteristics. They have limited authorities. They do not have exclusive authority over intelligence agencies. Appropriations are ultimately determined by the Appropriations Committees. The Armed Services Committees exercise jurisdiction over the intelligence agencies within the Department of Defense, and in the case of the Senate, over the Central Intelligence Agency. One consequence is that the rise and fall of intelligence budgets are tied directly to trends in defense spending. The President is required by law to ensure the Congressional Intelligence Committees are kept fully and currently informed of the intelligence activities of the United States. The committees allow the CIA, to some extent, to withhold information in order to protect sources, methods, and operations. The CIA must bring presidentially authorized covert action findings and memoranda of notification to the intelligence committees, and it must detail its failures. The committees conduct their most important work in closed hearings or briefings in which security over classified material can be maintained. Members of the Intelligence Committee serve for a limited time, a restriction imposed by each chamber. Many members believe these limits prevent committee members from developing the necessary expertise to conduct effective oversight. Secrecy, while necessary, can also harm oversight. The overall budget of the intelligence community is classified, as are most of its activities. Thus, the intelligence committees cannot take advantage of democracy's best oversight mechanism, public disclosure. This makes them significantly different from other congressional oversight committees, which are often spurred into action by the work of investigative journalists and watchdog organizations. Adjusting to the post-Cold War era. The unexpected and rapid end of the Cold War in 1999 created trauma in the foreign policy and national security community, both in and out of government. While some criticized the intelligence community for failing to forecast the collapse of the Soviet Union and used this argument to propose drastic cuts in intelligence agencies, most recognized that the good news of being relieved of the substantial burden of maintaining a security structure to meet the Soviet challenge was accompanied by the bad news of increased insecurity. In many directions, the community faced threats and intelligence challenges that it was largely unprepared to meet. So did the intelligence oversight committees. New digitized technologies and the demand for imagery and continued capability against older systems meant the need to spend more on satellite systems at the expense of human efforts. In addition, denial and deception became more effective as targets learned from public sources what our intelligence agencies were doing. There were comprehensive reform proposals of the intelligence community, such as those offered by Senators Bourne and McCurdy. That said, Congress still took too little action to address institutional weaknesses. With the Cold War over and the intelligence community roiled by the Ames spy scandal, a presidential commission chaired first by former Secretary of Defense Les Aspin and later by former Secretary of Defense Harold Brown examined the intelligence community's future. after it issued recommendations addressing the DCI's lack of personnel and budget authority over the intelligence community, the intelligence committees in 1996 introduced implementing legislation to remedy these problems. The Department of Defense and its congressional authorizing committees rose in opposition to the proposed changes. The President and the DCI did not actively support these changes. Relatively small changes made in 1996 gave the DCI consultative authority and created a new deputy for management and assistant DCIs for collection and analysis. These reforms occurred only after the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence took the unprecedented step of threatening to bring down the defense authorization bill. Indeed, rather than increasing the DCI's authorities over national intelligence, the 1990s witnessed movement in the opposite direction through, for example, the transfer of the CIA's imaging analysis capability to the new imagery and mapping agency created within the Department of Defense. Congress adjusts. Congress as a whole, like the executive branch, adjusted slowly to the rise of transnational terrorism as a threat to national security. In particular, the growing threat and capabilities of bin Laden were not understood in Congress. As the most representative branch of the federal government, Congress closely tracks trends in what public opinion and the electorate identify as key issues. In the years before September 11th, terrorism seldom registered as important. To the extent that terrorism did break through and engage the attention of the Congress as a whole, it would briefly command attention after a specific incident, and then return to a lower rung on the public policy agenda. Several points about Congress are worth noting. First, Congress always has a strong orientation toward domestic affairs. It usually takes on foreign policy and national security issues after threats are identified and articulated by the administration. In the absence of such a detailed and repeated articulation, national security tends not to rise very high on the list of congressional priorities. Presidents are selective in their use of political capital for international issues. In the decade before 9/11, presidential discussion of and congressional and public attention to foreign affairs and national security were dominated by other issues, among them Haiti, Bosnia, Russia, China, Somalia, Kosovo, NATO enlargement, the Middle East peace process, missile defense, and globalization. Terrorism infrequently took center stage, and when it did, the context was often terrorist tactics, a chemical, biological, nuclear, or computer threat, not terrorist organizations. Second, Congress tends to follow the overall lead of the President on budget issues with respect to national security matters. There are often sharp arguments about individual programs and internal priorities, but by and large, the overall funding authorized and appropriated by the Congress comes out close to the President's request. This tendency was certainly illustrated by the downward trends in spending on defense, intelligence, and foreign affairs in the first part of the 1990s. The White House, to be sure, read the political signals coming from Capitol Hill, but the Congress largely acceded to the executive branch's funding requests. In the second half of the decade, Congress appropriated some 98% of what the administration requested for intelligence programs. Apart from the Gingrich supplemental of $1.5 billion for overall intelligence programs in fiscal year 1999, the key decisions on overall allocation of resources for national security issues in the decade before 9/11, including counterterrorism funding, were made in the President's Office of Management and Budget. Third, Congress did not reorganize itself after the end of the Cold War to address new threats. Recommendations by the Joint Committee on the Organization of Congress were implemental, in part, in the House of Representatives after the 1994 elections, but there was no reorganization of national security functions. The Senate undertook no appreciable changes. Traditional issues, foreign policy, defense, intelligence, continued to be handled by committees whose structure remained largely unaltered, while issues such as transnational terrorism fell between the cracks. Terrorism came under the jurisdiction of at least 14 different committees in the House alone, and budget and oversight functions in the House and Senate concerning terrorism were also splintered badly among committees. Little effort was made to consider an integrated policy toward terrorism, which might range from identifying the threat to addressing vulnerabilities in critical infrastructure, and the piecemeal approach in the Congress contributed to the problems of the executive branch in formulating such a policy. Fourth, the oversight function of Congress has diminished over time. In recent years, traditional review of the administration of programs and the implementation of laws has been replaced by a focus on personal investigations, possible scandals, and issues designed to generate media attention. The unglamorous but essential work of oversight has been neglected, and few members, past or present, believe it's performed well. DCI Tenet told us, "We ran from threat to threat to threat. there was not a system in place to say, you got to go back and do this and this and this. Not just the DCI, but the entire executive branch needed help from Congress in addressing the questions of counterterrorism strategy and policy, looking past day-to-day concerns. Members of Congress, however, also found their time spent on such everyday matters, or in looking back to investigate mistakes, and often missed the big question, as did the executive branch. Staff tended as well to focus on parochial considerations, seeking to add or cut funding for individual, often small, programs, instead of emphasizing comprehensive oversight projects. Fifth, on certain issues, other priorities pointed Congress in a direction that was unhelpful in meeting the threats that were emerging in the months leading up to 9/11. Committees with oversight responsibility for aviation focused overwhelmingly on airport congestion and the economic health of the airlines, not aviation security. Committees with responsibility for the INS focused on the southwest border, not on terrorists. Justice Department officials told us that committees with responsibility for the FBI tightly restricted appropriations for improvements in information technology, in part because of concerns about the FBI's ability to manage such projects. Committees responsible for South Asia spent the decade of the 1990s imposing sanctions on Pakistan, leaving presidents with little leverage to alter Pakistan's policies before 9/11. Committees with responsibility for the Defense Department paid little heed to developing military responses to terrorism and stymied intelligence reform. All committees found themselves swamped in the minutiae of the budget process, with little time for consideration of longer-term questions, or what many members past and present told us was the proper conduct of oversight. Each of these trends contributed to what can only be described as Congress's slowness and inadequacy in treating the issue of terrorism in the years before 9/11. The legislative branch adjusted little and did not restructure itself to address changing threats. Its attention to terrorism was episodic and splintered across several committees. Congress gave little guidance to executive branch agencies, did not reform them in any significant way, and did not systematically perform oversight to identify, address, and attempt to resolve the many problems in national security and domestic agencies that became apparent in the aftermath of 9/11. Although individual representatives and senators took significant steps, the overall level of attention in the Congress to the terrorist threat was low. We examine the number of hearings on terrorism from January 1998 to September 2001. The Senate Armed Services Committee held 9, 4 related to the attack on the USS Cole. The House Armed Services Committee also held 9, 6 of them by a special oversight panel on terrorism. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee and its House counterpart both held 4. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, in addition to its annual worldwide threat hearing, held 8. Its House counterpart held perhaps 2 exclusively devoted to counterterrorism, plus the briefings by its terrorist working group. The Senate and House intelligence panels did not raise public and congressional attention on bin Laden and al-Qaeda prior to the joint inquiry into the attacks of September 11th, perhaps in part because of the classified nature of their work. Yet in the context of committees that each hold scores of hearings every year on issues in their jurisdiction, this list is not impressive. Terrorism was a second or third order priority within the committees of Congress responsible for national security. In fact, Congress had a distinct tendency to push questions of emerging national security threats off its own plate, leaving them for others to consider. Congress asked outside commissions to do the work that arguably was at the heart of its own oversight responsibilities. Beginning in 1999, the reports of these commissions made scores of recommendations to address terrorism and homeland security, but drew little attention from Congress. Most of their impact came after 9/11. Chapter 4. Responses to Al-Qaeda's Initial Attacks. Section 4.1. Before the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. Although the 1995 National Intelligence Estimate had warned of a new type of terrorism, many officials continued to think of terrorists as agents of states, Saudi Hezbollah acting for Iran against Khobar Towers, or as domestic criminals, Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City. As we pointed out in Chapter 3, the White House is not a natural locus for program management. Hence, government efforts to cope with terrorism were essentially the work of individual agencies. President Bill Clinton's counterterrorism presidential decision directives in 1995, number 39, and May 1998, number 62, reiterated that terrorism was a national security problem, not just a law enforcement issue. They reinforced the authority of the National Security Council to coordinate domestic as well as foreign counterterrorism efforts through Richard Clark and his interagency Counterterrorism Security Group. Spotlighting new concerns about unconventional attacks, these directives assigned tasks to lead agencies but did not differentiate types of terrorist threats. Thus, while Clark might prod or push agencies to act, what actually happened was usually decided at the State Department, the Pentagon, the CIA, or the Justice Department. The efforts of these agencies were sometimes energetic and sometimes effective. Terrorist plots were disrupted and individual terrorists were captured, but the United States did not, before 9/11, adopt as a clear strategic objective the elimination of al-Qaeda. Early efforts against bin Laden. Until 1996, hardly anyone in the U.S. government understood that Osama bin Laden was an inspirer and organizer of the new terrorism. In 1993, the CIA noted that he'd paid for the training of some Egyptian terrorists in Sudan. The State Department detected his money and aid to the Yemeni terrorists, who set a bomb in an attempt to kill U.S. troops in Aden in 1992. Department sources even saw suspicious links with Omar Abdelrahman, the blind sheikh in the New York area, commenting that bin Laden seemed committed to financing jihads against anti-Islamic regimes worldwide. After the department designated Sudan a state sponsor of terrorism in 1993, it put bin Laden on its tip-off watch list, a move that might have prevented his getting a visa had he tried to enter the United States. As late as 1997, however, even the CIA's Counterterrorist Center continued to describe him as an extremist financier. In 1996, the CIA set up a special unit of a dozen officers to analyze intelligence on and plan operations against bin Laden. David Cohen, the head of the CIA's Directorate of Operations, wanted to test the idea of having a virtual station, a station based at headquarters but collecting and operating against its subject much as stations in the field focus on a country. Taking his cue from National Security Advisor Anthony Lake, who expressed special interest in terrorist finance, Cohen formed his virtual station as a terrorist financial links unit. He had trouble getting any Directorate of Operations office to run it. He finally recruited a former analyst who was then running the Islamic Extremist branch of the Counterterrorism Center. This officer, who was especially knowledgeable about Afghanistan, had noticed a recent stream of reports about bin Laden and something called al-Qaeda, and suggested to Cohen that the station focus on this one individual. Cohen agreed. Thus was born the bin Laden unit. In May 1996, bin Laden left Sudan for Afghanistan. A few months later, as the bin Laden unit was gearing up, Jamal Ahmed al-Fadl walked into a U.S. embassy in Africa, established his bona fides as a former senior employee of bin Laden, and provided a major breakthrough of intelligence on the creation, character, direction, and intentions of al-Qaeda. Corroborating evidence came from another walk-in source at a different U.S. embassy. More confirmation was supplied later that year by intelligence and other sources, including material gathered by FBI agents and Kenyan police from an al-Qaeda cell in Nairobi. By 1997, officers in the bin Laden unit recognized that bin Laden was more than just a financier. They learned that al-Qaeda had a military committee that was planning operations against U.S. interests worldwide and was actively trying to obtain nuclear material. Analysts assigned to the station looked at the information it had gathered and found connections everywhere, including links to the attacks on U.S. troops in Aden and Somalia in 1992 and 93, and to the Manila air plot in the Philippines in 1994 and 95. The bin Laden station was already working on plans for offensive operations against bin Laden. These plans were directed at both physical assets and sources of finance. In the end, plans to identify and attack bin Laden's money sources did not go forward. In late 1995, when bin Laden was still in Sudan, the State Department and the CIA learned that Sudanese officials were discussing with the Saudi government the possibility of expelling bin Laden. U.S. Ambassador Timothy Carney encouraged the Sudanese to pursue this course. The Saudis, however, did not want bin Laden, giving as their reason their revocation of his citizenship. Sudan's Minister of Defense, Fatih Erwa, has claimed that Sudan offered to hand bin Laden over to the United States. The commission has found no credible evidence that this was so. Ambassador Carney had instructions only to push the Sudanese to expel bin Laden. Ambassador Carney had no legal basis to ask for more from the Sudanese, since at the time there was no indictment outstanding. The chief of the bin Laden station, whom we will call Mike, saw bin Laden's move to Afghanistan as a stroke of luck. Though the CIA had virtually abandoned Afghanistan after the Soviet withdrawal, case officers had reestablished old contacts while tracking down Mir Amal Khanzi, the Pakistani gunman who had murdered two CIA employees in January 1993. These contacts contributed to intelligence about bin Laden's local movements, business activities and security and living arrangements, and helped provide evidence that he was spending large amounts of money to help the Taliban. The chief of the Counterterrorism Center, who we will call Jeff, told Director George Tenet that the CIA's intelligence assets were near to providing real-time information about bin Laden's activities and travels in Afghanistan. One of the contacts was a group associated with particular tribes among Afghanistan's ethnic Pashtun community. By the fall of 1997, the bin Laden unit had roughed out a plan for these Afghan tribals to capture bin Laden and hand him over for trial either in the United States or in an Arab country. In early 1998, the Cabinet-level Principals Committee apparently gave the concept its blessing. On their own separate track, getting information but not direction from the CIA, the FBI's New York field office, and the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, were preparing to ask a grand jury to indict bin Laden. The Counter-Terrorist Center knew that this was happening. The eventual charge, conspiring to attack U.S. defense installations, was finally issued from the grand jury in June 1998 as a sealed indictment. The indictment was publicly disclosed in November of that year. When bin Laden moved to Afghanistan in May 1996, he became a subject of interest to the State Department's South Asia Bureau. At the time, as one diplomat told us, South Asia was seen in the department and the government generally as a low priority. In 1997, as Madeleine Albright was beginning her tenure as Secretary of State, an NSC policy review concluded that the United States should pay more attention not just to India, but also to Pakistan and Afghanistan. With regard to Afghanistan, another diplomat said the United States at the time had no policy. In the State Department, concerns about India-Pakistan tensions often crowded out attention to Afghanistan or bin Laden. Aware of instability and growing Islamic extremism in Pakistan, State Department officials worried most about an arms race and possible war between Pakistan and India. After May 1998, when both countries surprised the United States by testing nuclear weapons, these dangers became daily first-order concerns of the State Department. In Afghanistan, the State Department tried to end the civil war that had continued since the Soviets' withdrawal. The South Asia Bureau believed it might have a carrot for Afghanistan's warring factions in a project by the Union Oil Company of California, or UNICAL, to build a pipeline across the country. While there was probably never much chance of the pipeline actually being built, the Afghan desk hoped that the prospect of shared pipeline profits might lure faction leaders to a conference table. U.S. diplomats did not favor the Taliban over the rival factions. Despite growing concerns, U.S. diplomats were willing at the time, as one official said, to give the Taliban a chance. Though Secretary Albright made no secret of thinking the Taliban despicable, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Bill Richardson, led a delegation to South Asia, including Afghanistan, in April 1998. No U.S. official of such rank had been to Kabul in decades. Ambassador Richardson went primarily to urge negotiations to end the civil war. In view of bin Laden's recent public call for all Muslims to kill Americans, Richardson asked the Taliban to expel bin Laden. They answered that they did not know his whereabouts. In any case, the Taliban said bin Laden was not a threat to the U.S. In sum, in late 1997, in the spring of 1998, the lead U.S. agencies each pursued their own efforts against bin Laden. The CIA's Counterterrorist Center was developing a plan to capture and remove him from Afghanistan. Parts of the Justice Department were moving toward indicting bin Laden, making possible a criminal trial in a New York court. Meanwhile, the State Department was focused more on lessening Indo-Pakistani nuclear tensions, ending the Afghan civil war, and ameliorating the Taliban's human rights abuses than on driving out bin Laden. Another key actor, Marine General Anthony Zinni, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Central Command, shared the State Department's view. The CIA develops a capture plan. Initially, the DCI's Counter-Terrorist Center and its bin Laden unit had considered a plan to ambush bin Laden when he traveled between Kandahar, the Taliban capital where he sometimes stayed the night, and his primary residence at the time, Tarnak Farms. After the Afghan tribals reported that they'd tried such an ambush and failed, the center gave up on it, despite suspicions that the tribal story might be fiction. Thereafter, the capture plan focused on a nighttime raid on Tarnak Farms. A compound of about 80 concrete or mud brick buildings surrounded by a 10-foot wall, Tarnak Farms was located in an isolated desert area on the outskirts of the Kandahar airport. CIA officers were able to map the entire site, intensifying the houses that belonged to bin Laden's wives and the one where bin Laden himself was most likely to sleep. Working with the tribals, they drew up plans for the raid. They ran two complete rehearsals in the United States during the fall of 1997. By early 1998, planners at the Counter-Terrorist Center were ready to come back to the White House to seek formal approval. Tenet apparently walked National Security Advisor Sandy Berger through the basic plan on February 13th. One group of tribals would subdue the guards, enter Tarnak Farm stealthily, grab bin Laden, take him to a desert site outside Kandahar, and turn him over to a second group. This second group of tribals would take him to the desert landing zone, already tested in the 1997 Kanzi capture. From there, a CIA plane would take him to New York, an Arab capital, or wherever he was to be arraigned. Briefing papers prepared by the Counter-Terrorist Center acknowledged that hitches might develop. People might be killed, and bin Laden's supporters might retaliate, perhaps taking U.S. citizens in Kandahar hostage. But the briefing papers also noted that there was risk in not acting. Sooner or later, they said, bin Laden will attack U.S. interests, perhaps using WMDs. Clark's counterterrorism security group reviewed the capture plan for Berger, noting that the plan was in a very early stage of development. The NSC staff then told the CIA planners to go ahead and, among other things, start drafting any legal documents that might be required to authorize the covert action. The CSG apparently stressed that the raid should target bin Laden himself and not the whole compound. The CIA planners conducted their third complete rehearsal in March, and they again briefed the CSG. Clark wrote Berger on March 7th that he saw the operation as somewhat embryonic and the CIA as months away from doing anything. Mike thought the capture plan was the perfect operation. It required minimum infrastructure. The plan had now been modified so that the tribals would keep bin Laden in a hiding place for up to a month before turning him over to the United States, thereby increasing the chances of keeping the U.S. hand out of sight. Mike trusted the information from the Afghan network. It had been corroborated by other means, he told us. The lead CIA officer in the field, Gary Schroen, also had confidence in the tribals. In a May 6th cable to CIA headquarters, he pronounced their planning almost as professional and detailed as would be done by any U.S. military special operations element. He and the other officers who had worked through the plan with the tribals judged it about as good as it can be. By that, Schroen explained, he meant that the chance of capturing or killing bin Laden was about 40%. Although the tribals thought they could pull off the raid if the operation were approved by headquarters and the policymakers, Schroen wrote that there was going to be a point when we step back and keep our fingers crossed that the tribals prove as good and as lucky as they think they will be. Military officers reviewed the capture plan and, according to Mike, found no showstoppers. The commander of Delta Force felt uncomfortable with having the tribals hold bin Laden captive for so long, and the commander of Joint Special Operations Forces, Lieutenant General Michael Canavan, was worried about the safety of the tribals inside Tarnak Farms. General Canavan said he'd actually thought that the operation was too complicated for the CIA, out of their league, and an effort to get results on the cheap. But a senior Joint Staff Officer described the plan as generally not too much different than we might have come up with ourselves. No one in the Pentagon, so far as we know, advised the CIA or the White House not to proceed. In Washington, Berger expressed doubt about the dependability of the tribals. In his meeting with Tenet, Berger focused most, however, on the question of what was to be done with bin Laden if he were actually captured. He worried that the hard evidence against bin Laden was still skimpy and that there was a danger of snatching him and bringing him to the United States, only to see him acquitted. On May 18th, CIA's managers reviewed a draft memorandum of notification, a legal document authorizing the capture operation. A 1986 presidential finding had authorized worldwide covert action against terrorism and probably provided adequate authority. But mindful of the old rogue elephant charge, senior CIA managers may have wanted something on paper to show that they were not acting on their own. Discussions of this memorandum brought to the surface an unease about paramilitary covert action that had become ingrained, at least among some CIA senior managers. James Pavitt, the assistant head of the Directorate of Operations, expressed concern that people might get killed. It appears he thought the operation had at least a slight flavor of a plan for an assassination. Moreover, he calculated that it would cost several million dollars. He was not prepared to take that money out of hide, and he did not want to go to all the necessary congressional committees to get special money. Despite Pavitt's misgivings, the CIA leadership cleared the draft memorandum and sent it on to the National Security Council. Counter-Terrorist Center officers briefed Attorney General Janet Reno and FBI Director Louis Free, telling them that the operation had about a 30% chance of success. The center's chief, Jeff, joined by John O'Neill, the head of the FBI's New York field office, in briefing Mary Jo White, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, and her staff. Though Jeff also used the 30% success figure, he warned that someone would surely be killed in the operation. White's impression from the New York briefing was that the chances of capturing bin Laden alive were nil. From May 20th to 24th, the CIA ran a final graded rehearsal of the operation, spread over three time zones, even bringing in personnel from the region. The FBI also participated. The rehearsal went well. The Counterterrorist Center planned to brief cabinet-level principals and their deputies the following week, giving June 23rd as the date for the raid, with bin Laden to be brought out of Afghanistan no later than July 23rd. On May 20th, Director Tenet discussed the high risk of the operation with Berger and his deputies, warning that people might be killed, including bin Laden. Success was to be defined as the exfiltration of bin Laden out of Afghanistan. A meeting of principals was scheduled for May 29th to decide whether the operation should go ahead. The principals did not meet. On May 29th, Jeff informed Mike that he'd just met with Tenet, Pavitt, and the chief of the directorate's Near Eastern Division. The decision was made not to go ahead with the operation. Mike cabled the field that he'd been directed to stand down on the operation for the time being. He'd been told, he wrote, that cabinet-level officials thought the risk of civilian casualties, collateral damage, was too high. They were concerned about the tribal safety and had worried that the purpose and nature of the operation would be subject to unavoidable misinterpretation and misrepresentation, and probably recriminations, in the event that bin Laden, despite our best intentions and efforts, did not survive. Impressions vary as to who actually decided not to proceed with the operation. Clark told us that the CSG saw the plan as flawed. He was said to have described it to a colleague on the NSC staff as half-assed and predicted that the principals would not approve it. Jeff thought the decision had been made at the cabinet level. Pavitt thought that it was Berger's doing, though perhaps on Tenet's advice. Tenet told us that given the recommendation of his chief operations officers, he alone had decided to turn off the operation. He'd simply informed Berger, who had not pushed back. Berger's recollection was similar. He said the plan was never presented to the White House for a decision. The CIA senior management clearly did not think the plan would work. Tenet's deputy director of operations wrote to Berger a few weeks later that the CIA assessed the tribal's ability to capture bin Laden and deliver him to U.S. officials as low. But working-level CIA officers were disappointed. Before it was canceled, Schroen described it as the best plan we're going to come up with to capture bin Laden while he's in Afghanistan and bring him to justice. No capture plan before 9/11 ever again attained the same level of detail and preparation. The tribal's reported readiness to act diminished, and bin Laden's security precautions and defenses became more elaborate and formidable. At this time, 9/11 was more than 3 years away. It was the duty of Tenet and the CIA leadership to balance the risks of inaction against jeopardizing the lives of their operatives and agents. And they had reason to worry about failure, millions of dollars down the drain, a shootout that could be seen as an assassination, and if there were repercussions in Pakistan, perhaps a coup. The decisions of the U.S. government in May 1998 were made, as Berger has put it, from the vantage point of the driver looking through a muddy windshield moving forward, not through a clean rearview mirror. Looking for other options. The Counter-Terrorist Center continued to track bin Laden and to contemplate covert action. The most hopeful possibility seemed now to lie in diplomacy, but not diplomacy managed by the Department of State, which focused primarily on India-Pakistan nuclear tensions during the summer of 1998. The CIA learned in the spring of 1998 that the Saudi government had quietly disrupted bin Laden's cells in its country that were planning to attack U.S. forces with shoulder-fired missiles. They had arrested scores of individuals with no publicity. When thanking the Saudis, Director Tenet took advantage of the opening to ask them to help against bin Laden. The response was encouraging enough that President Clinton made Tenet his informal personal representative to work with the Saudis on terrorism, and Tenet visited Riyadh in May and again in early June. Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah, who'd taken charge from the ailing King Fahd, promised Tenet an all-out secret effort to persuade the Taliban to expel bin Laden so that he could be sent to the United States or to another country for trial. The kingdom's emissary would be its intelligence chief, Prince Turki bin Faisal. Vice President Al Gore later added his thanks to those of Tenet, both making clear that they spoke with President Clinton's blessing. Tenet reported that it was imperative to get an indictment against bin Laden. The New York grand jury issued its sealed indictment a few days later on June 10th. Tenet also recommended that no action be taken on other U.S. options, such as the covert action plan. Prince Turki followed up in meetings during the summer with Mullah Omar and other Taliban leaders, apparently employing a mixture of possible incentives and threats. Turki received a commitment that bin Laden would be expelled, but Mullah Omar did not make good on this promise. On August 5th, Clark chaired a CSG meeting on bin Laden. In the discussion about what might be done, the note-taker wrote, "There was a dearth of bright ideas around the table, despite a consensus that the government ought to pursue every avenue it can to address the problem." Section 4.2. Crisis, August 1998. On August 7, 1998, National Security Advisor Berger woke President Clinton with a phone call at 5:35 a.m. to tell him of the almost simultaneous bombings of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Suspicion quickly focused on bin Laden, unusually good intelligence chiefly from the year-long monitoring of al-Qaeda's cell in Nairobi, soon firmly fixed responsibility on him and his associates. Debate about what to do settled very soon on one option: Tomahawk cruise missiles. Months earlier, after cancellation of the covert capture operation, Clark had prodded the Pentagon to explore possibilities for military action. On June 2nd, General Hugh Shelton, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had directed General Zinni at Central Command to develop a plan, which he'd submitted during the first week of July. Zinni's planners surely considered the two previous times the United States had used force to respond to terrorism, the 1986 strike on Libya and the 1993 strike against Iraq. They proposed firing Tomahawks against 8 terrorist camps in Afghanistan, including bin Laden's compound at Tarnak Farms. After the embassy attack, the Pentagon offered this plan to the White House. The day after the embassy bombings, Tenet brought to a principals' meeting intelligence that terrorist leaders were expected to gather at a camp near Khost, Afghanistan, to plan future attacks. According to Berger, Tenet said that several hundred would attend, including bin Laden. The CIA described the area as effectively a military cantonment, away from civilian population centers and overwhelmingly populated by jihadists. Clark remembered sitting next to Tenet in a White House meeting asking Tenet, "You thinking what I'm thinking?" and his nodding, "Yes." The principals quickly reached a consensus on attacking the gathering. The strike's purpose was to kill bin Laden and his chief lieutenants. Berger put in place a tightly compartmented process designed to keep all planning secret. On August 11th, General Zinni received orders to prepare detailed plans for strikes against the sites in Afghanistan. The Pentagon briefed President Clinton about these plans on August 12th and 14th. Though the principals hoped that the missiles would hit bin Laden, NSC staff recommended the strike whether or not there was firm evidence that the commanders were at the facilities. Considerable debate went to the question of whether to strike targets outside of Afghanistan, including 2 facilities in Sudan. One was a tannery believed to belong to bin Laden. The other was Al-Shifa, a Khartoum pharmaceutical plant, which intelligence reports said was manufacturing a precursor ingredient for nerve gas with bin Laden's financial support. The argument for hitting the tannery was that it could hurt bin Laden financially. The argument for hitting Al-Shifa was that it would lessen the chance of bin Laden's having nerve gas for a later attack. Ever since March 1995, American officials had had in the backs of their minds Aum Shinrikyo's release of sarin nerve gas in the Tokyo subway. President Clinton himself had expressed great concern about chemical and biological terrorism in the United States. Bin Laden had reportedly been heard to speak of wanting a Hiroshima and at least 10,000 casualties. The CIA reported that a soil sample from the vicinity of the Al-Shifa plant had tested positive for EMTA, a precursor chemical for VX, a nerve gas whose lone use was for mass killing. 2 days before the embassy bombings, Clark's staff wrote that bin Laden has invested in and almost certainly has access to VX, produced at a plant in Sudan. Senior State Department officials believed that they'd received a similar verdict independently, though they and Clark's staff were probably relying on the same report. Mary McCarthy, the NSC senior director responsible for intelligence programs, initially cautioned Berger that the bottom line was that we will need much better intelligence on this facility before we seriously consider any options. She added that the link between bin Laden and Al-Shifa was rather uncertain at this point. Berger has told us that he thought about what might happen if the decision went against hitting Al-Shifa and nerve gas was used in a New York subway 2 weeks later. By the early hours on the morning of August 20th, President Clinton and all his principal advisors had agreed to strike bin Laden camps in Afghanistan near Khost, as well as hitting Al-Shifa. The president took the Sudanese tannery off the target list because he saw little point in killing uninvolved people without doing significant harm to bin Laden. The principal with the most qualms regarding Al-Shifa was Attorney General Reno. She expressed concern about attacking 2 Muslim countries at the same time. Looking back, she said that she felt the premise kept shifting. Later on August 20th, Navy vessels in the Arabian Sea fired their cruise missiles. Though most of them hit their intended targets, neither bin Laden nor any other terrorist leader was killed. Berger told us that an after-action review by Director Tenet concluded that the strikes had killed 20 to 30 people in the camps, but probably missed bin Laden by a few hours. Since the missiles headed for Afghanistan had to cross Pakistan, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs was sent to meet with Pakistan's Army Chief of Staff to assure him the missiles were not coming from India. Officials in Washington speculated that one or another Pakistani official might have sent a warning to the Taliban or bin Laden. The airstrikes marked the climax of an intense 48-hour period in which Berger notified congressional leaders. The principals called their foreign counterparts, and President Clinton flew back from his vacation on Martha's Vineyard to address the nation from the Oval Office. The president spoke to the congressional leadership from Air Force One, and he called Prime Minister Tony Blair, Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, and Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak from the White House. House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott initially supported the president. The next month, Gingrich's office dismissed the cruise missile attacks as pinpricks. At the time, President Clinton was embroiled in the Lewinsky scandal, which continued to consume public attention for the rest of that year and the first months of 1999. As it happened, a popular 1997 movie, Wag the Dog, features a president who fakes a war to distract public attention from a domestic scandal. Some Republicans in Congress raised questions about the timing of the strikes. Berger was particularly rankled by an editorial in The Economist that said that only the future would tell whether the U.S. missile strikes had created 10,000 new fanatics where there would have been none. Much public commentary turned immediately to scalding criticism that the action was too aggressive. The Sudanese denied that Al-Shifa produced nerve gas, and they allowed journalists to visit what was left of a seemingly harmless facility. President Clinton, Vice President Gore, Berger, Tenet, and Clark insisted to us that their judgment was right, pointing to the soil sample evidence. No independent evidence has emerged to corroborate the CIA's assessment. Everyone involved in the decision had, of course, been aware of President Clinton's problems. He told them to ignore them. Berger recalled the president saying to him that they were going to get crap either way, so they should do the right thing. All his aides testified to us that they based their advice solely on national security considerations. We found no reason to question their statements. The failure of the strikes, the wag the dog slur, the intense partisanship of the period, and the nature of the Al-Shifa evidence likely had a cumulative effect on the future decisions about the use of force against bin Laden. Berger told us that he did not feel any sense of constraint. The period after the August 1998 embassy bombings was critical in shaping U.S. policy toward bin Laden. Although more Americans had been killed in the 1996 Khobar Towers attack and many more in Beirut in 1983, the overall loss of life rivaled the worst attacks in memory. More ominous, perhaps, was the demonstration of an operational capability to coordinate two nearly simultaneous attacks on U.S. embassies in different countries. Despite the availability of information that Al-Qaeda was a global network in 1998, policymakers knew little about the organization. The reams of new information that the CIA's bin Laden unit had been developing since 1996 had not been pulled together and synthesized for the rest of the government. Indeed, analysts in the unit felt that they were viewed as alarmist, even within the CIA. A national intelligence estimate on terrorism in 1997 had only briefly mentioned bin Laden, and no subsequent national estimate would authoritatively evaluate the terrorism danger until after 9/11. Policymakers knew there was a dangerous individual, Osama bin Laden, whom they'd been trying to capture and bring to trial. Documents at the time referred to bin Laden and his associates, or bin Laden and his network. They did not emphasize the existence of a structured worldwide organization gearing up to train thousands of potential terrorists. In the critical days and weeks after the August 1998 attacks, senior policymakers in the Clinton administration had to reevaluate the threat posed by bin Laden. Was this just a new and especially venomous version of the ordinary terrorist threat America had lived with for decades, or was it radically new, posing a danger beyond any yet experienced? Even after the embassy attacks, bin Laden had been responsible for the deaths of fewer than 50 Americans, most of them overseas. An NSC staffer working for Richard Clark told us the threat was seen as one that could cause hundreds of casualties, not thousands. Even officials who acknowledge a vital threat intellectually may not be ready to act on such beliefs at great cost or at high risk. Therefore, the government experts who believed that bin Laden and his network posed such a novel danger needed a way to win broad support for their views, or at least spotlight the areas of dispute. The presidential daily brief and the similar, more widely circulated daily reports for high officials, consisting mainly of brief reports of intelligence news without much analysis or context, did not provide such a vehicle. The National Intelligence Estimate has often played this role and is sometimes controversial for this very reason. It played no role in judging the threat posed by al-Qaeda, either in 1998 or later. In the late summer and fall of 1998, the U.S. government also was worrying about the deployment of military power in two other ongoing conflicts. After years of war in the Balkans, the United States had finally committed itself to significant military intervention in 1995 and 96. Already maintaining a NATO-led peacekeeping force in Bosnia, U.S. officials were beginning to consider major combat operations against Serbia to protect Muslim civilians in Kosovo from ethnic cleansing. Airstrikes were threatened in October 1998. A full-scale NATO bombing campaign against Serbia was launched in March 1999. In addition, the Clinton administration was facing the possibility of major combat operations against Iraq. Since 1996, the UN inspections regime had been increasingly obstructed by Saddam Hussein. The United States was threatening to attack unless unfettered inspections could resume. The Clinton administration eventually launched a large-scale set of airstrikes against Iraq, Operation Desert Fox, in December 1998. These military commitments became the context in which the Clinton administration had to consider opening another front of military engagement against a new terrorist threat based in Afghanistan. A follow-on campaign? Clark hoped the August 1998 missile strikes would mark the beginning of a sustained campaign against bin Laden. Clark was, as he later admitted, obsessed with bin Laden, and the embassy bombings gave him new scope for pursuing his obsession. Terrorism had moved high up among the president's concerns, and Clark's position had elevated accordingly. The CSG, unlike most standing interagency committees, did not have to report through the deputies' committee, although such a reporting relationship had been prescribed in the May 1998 presidential directive, after expressions of concern by Attorney General Reno, among others. That directive contained an exception that permitted the CSG to report directly to the principals if Berger so elected. In practice, the CSG often reported not even to the full principals' committee, but instead to the so-called small group formed by Berger, consisting only of those principals cleared to know about the most sensitive issues connected with counterterrorism activities concerning bin Laden or the Khobar Towers investigation. For this inner cabinet, Clark drew up what he called Political Military Plan Delenda. The Latin delenda, meaning that something must be destroyed, evokes the famous Roman vow to destroy its rival, Carthage. The overall goal of Clark's paper was to immediately eliminate any significant threat to Americans from the bin Laden network. The paper called for diplomacy to deny bin Laden sanctuary, covert action to disrupt terrorist activities, but above all to capture bin Laden and his deputies and bring them to trial, efforts to dry up bin Laden's money supply, and preparation for follow-up on military action. The status of the document was and remained uncertain. It was never formally adopted by the principals, and participants in the small group now have little or no recollection of it. It did, however, guide Clark's efforts. The military component of Clark's plan was its most fully articulated element. He envisioned an ongoing campaign of strikes against bin Laden's bases in Afghanistan or elsewhere, whenever target information was ripe. Acknowledging that individual targets might not have much value, he cautioned Berger not to expect ever again to have an assembly of terrorist leaders in his sights. But he argued that rolling attacks might persuade the Taliban to hand over bin Laden, and in any case, would show that the action in August was not a one-off event. It would show that the United States was committed to a relentless effort to take down bin Laden's network. Members of the small group found themselves unpersuaded of the merits of rolling attacks. Defense Secretary William Cohen told us bin Laden's training camps were primitive, built with rope ladders. General Shelton called them jungle gym camps. Neither thought them worthwhile targets for very expensive missiles. President Clinton and Berger also worried about the Economist's point, that attacks that missed bin Laden could enhance his stature and win him new recruits. After the United States launched air attacks against Iraq at the end of 1998 and against Serbia in 1999, in each case provoking worldwide criticism, Deputy National Security Advisor James Steinberg added the argument that attacks in Afghanistan offer little benefit, lots of blowback against a bomb-happy U.S. During the last week of August 1998, officials began considering possible follow-on strikes. According to Clark, President Clinton was inclined to launch further strikes sooner rather than later. On August 27th, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Walter Slocum advised Secretary Cohen that the available targets were not promising. "The experience of the previous week," he wrote, "has only confirmed the importance of defining a clearly articulated rationale for military action that was effective as well as justified." But Slocum worried that simply striking some of these available targets did not add up to an effective strategy. Defense officials at a lower level in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict tried to meet Slocum's objections. They developed a plan that, unlike Clark's, called not for particular strikes but instead for a broad change in national strategy and in the institutional approach of the Department of Defense, implying a possible need for large-scale operations across the whole spectrum of U.S. military capabilities. It urged the department to become a lead agency in driving a national counterterrorism strategy forward, to champion a national effort to take up the gauntlet that international terrorists have thrown at our feet. The authors expressed concern that we've not fundamentally altered our own philosophy or our approach, even though the terrorist threat had grown. They outlined an 8-party strategy to be more proactive and aggressive. The future, they warned, might bring horrific attacks, in which case we will have no choice, nor, unfortunately, will we have a plan. The Assistant Secretary, Alan Holmes, took the paper to Slocum's chief deputy, Jan Lodell, but it went no further. Its lead author recalls being told by Holmes that Lodell thought it was too aggressive. Holmes cannot recall what was said, and Lodell cannot remember the episode or the paper at all. Section 4.3. Diplomacy. After the August missile strikes, diplomatic options to press the Taliban seemed no more promising than military options. The United States had issued a formal warning to the Taliban, and also to Sudan, that they would be held directly responsible for any attacks on Americans, wherever they occurred, carried out by bin Laden's network as long as they continued to provide sanctuary to it. For a brief moment, it had seemed as if the August strikes might have shocked the Taliban into thinking of giving up bin Laden. On August 22nd, the reclusive Mullah Omar told a working-level State Department official that the strikes were counterproductive, but added that he would be open to a dialogue with the United States on bin Laden's presence in Afghanistan. Meeting in Islamabad with William Milam, the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, Taliban delegates said it was against their culture to expel someone seeking sanctuary, but asked what would happen to bin Laden should he be sent to Saudi Arabia. Yet in September 1998, when the Saudi emissary, Prince Turki, asked Mullah Omar whether he would keep his earlier promise to expel bin Laden, the Taliban leader said no. Both sides shouted at each other, with Mullah Omar denouncing the Saudi government. Riyadh then suspended its diplomatic relations with the Taliban regime. Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and the United Arab Emirates were the only countries that recognized the Taliban as the legitimate government of Afghanistan. Crown Prince Abdullah told President Clinton and Vice President Gore about this when he visited Washington in late September. His account confirmed reports that the U.S. government had received independently. Other efforts with the Saudi government centered on improving intelligence sharing and permitting U.S. agents to interrogate prisoners in Saudi custody. The history of such cooperation in 1997 and 1998 had been strained. Several officials told us in particular that the United States could not get direct access to an important al-Qaeda financial official, Madani al-Tayyib, who had been detained by the Saudi government in 1997. Though U.S. officials repeatedly raised the issue, the Saudis provided limited information. In his September 1998 meeting with Crown Prince Abdullah, Vice President Gore, while thanking the Saudi government for their responsiveness, renewed the request for direct U.S. access to Tayyib. The United States never obtained this access. An NSC staff-led working group on terrorist finances asked the CIA in November 1998 to push again for access to Tayyib and to see if it is possible to elaborate further on the ties between Osama bin Laden and prominent individuals in Saudi Arabia, including especially the bin Laden family. One result was two NSC-led interagency trips to Persian Gulf states in 1999 and 2000. During these trips, the NSC, Treasury and Intelligence representatives, spoke with Saudi officials and later interviewed members of the bin Laden family about Osama's inheritance. The Saudis and the bin Laden family eventually helped in this particular effort, and U.S. officials ultimately learned that bin Laden was not financing al-Qaeda out of a personal inheritance. But Clark was frustrated about how little the agency knew, complaining to Berger that 4 years after we first asked CIA to track down bin Laden's finances, and 2 years after the creation of the CIA's bin Laden unit, the agency said it could only guess at how much aid bin Laden gave to terrorist groups, and what were the main sources of his budget, or how he moved his money. The other diplomatic route to get at bin Laden in Afghanistan ran through Islamabad. In the summer before the embassy bombings, the State Department had been heavily focused on rising tensions between India and Pakistan and did not aggressively challenge Pakistan on Afghanistan and bin Laden. But State Department counterterrorism officials wanted a stronger position. The department's acting counterterrorism coordinator advised Secretary Albright to designate Pakistan as a state sponsor of terrorism, noting that despite high-level Pakistani assurances, the country's military intelligence service continued activities in support of international terrorism by supporting attacks on civilian targets in Kashmir. This recommendation was opposed by the State Department's South Asia Bureau, which was concerned that it would damage already sensitive relations with Pakistan in the wake of the May 1998 nuclear tests by both Pakistan and India. Secretary Albright rejected the recommendation on August 5, 1998, just 2 days before the embassy bombings. She told us that, in general, putting the Pakistanis on the terrorist list would eliminate any influence the United States had over them. In October, an NSC counterterrorism official noted that Pakistan's pro-Taliban military intelligence service had been training Kashmiri jihadists in one of the camps hit by U.S. missiles, leading to the deaths of Pakistanis. After flying to Nairobi and bringing home the coffins of the American dead, Secretary Albright increased the department's focus on counterterrorism. According to Ambassador Milam, the bombings were a wake-up call, and he soon found himself spending 45% to 50% of his time working the Taliban bin Laden portfolio. But Pakistan's military intelligence service, known as the ISID, Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, was the Taliban's primary patron, which made progress difficult. Additional pressure on the Pakistanis, beyond demands to press the Taliban on bin Laden, seemed unattractive to most officials of the State Department. Congressional sanctions punishing Pakistan for possessing nuclear arms prevented the administration from offering incentives to Islamabad. In the words of Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot, Washington's Pakistan policy was stick-heavy. Talbot felt that the only remaining sticks were additional sanctions that would have bankrupted the Pakistanis, a dangerous move that could have brought total chaos to a nuclear-armed country with a significant number of Islamic radicals. The Saudi government, which had a long and close relationship with Pakistan and provided it oil on generous terms, was already pressing Sharif with regard to the Taliban and bin Laden. A senior State Department official concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah put a tremendous amount of heat on the Pakistani Prime Minister during the Prince's October 1998 visit to Pakistan. The State Department urged President Clinton to engage the Pakistanis. Accepting this advice, President Clinton invited Sharif to Washington, where they talked mostly about India, but also discussed bin Laden. After Sharif went home, the president called him and raised the bin Laden subject again. The effort elicited from Sharif were promised to talk with the Taliban. Mullah Omar's position showed no sign of softening. One intelligence report passed to Berger by the NSC staff quoted bin Laden as saying that Mullah Omar had given him a completely free hand to act in any country, though asking that he not claim responsibility for attacks in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden was described as grabbing his beard and saying emotionally, "By Allah, by God, the Americans will still be amazed. The so-called United States will suffer the same fate as the Russians. Their state will collapse too." Debate in the State Department intensified after December 1998, when Michael Sheehan became counterterrorism coordinator. A one-time Special Forces officer, he'd worked with Albright when she was ambassador to the United Nations and had served on the NSC staff with Clark. He shared Clark's obsession with terrorism and had little hesitation about locking horns with the regional bureaus. Through every available channel, he repeated the earlier warning to the Taliban of the possible dire consequences, including military strikes, if bin Laden remained their guest and conducted additional attacks. Within the department, he argued for designating the Taliban regime a state sponsor of terrorism. This was technically difficult to do, for calling it a state would be tantamount to diplomatic recognition, which the United States had thus far withheld. But Sheehan urged the use of any available weapon against the Taliban. He told us that he thought he was regarded in the department as a one-note Johnny Nutcase. In early 1999, the State Department's Counterterrorism Office proposed a comprehensive diplomatic strategy for all states involved in the Afghanistan problem, including Pakistan. It specified both carrots and hard-hitting sticks, among them certifying Pakistan as uncooperative on terrorism. Albright said the original carrots and sticks listed in a decision paper for principles may not have been used as described on paper, but added that they were used in other ways or in varying degrees. But the paper's author, Ambassador Sheehan, was frustrated and complained to us that the original plan had been watered down to the point that nothing was then done with it. The cautiousness of the South Asia Bureau was reinforced when, in May 1999, Pakistani troops were discovered to have infiltrated into an especially mountainous area of Kashmir. A limited war began between India and Pakistan, euphemistically called the Kargil Crisis, as India tried to drive the Pakistani forces out. Patience with Pakistan was wearing thin inside the State Department and the NSC. Bruce Rydell, the NSC staff member responsible for Pakistan, wrote Berger that Islamabad was behaving as a rogue state in two areas, backing Taliban UBL terror and provoking war with India. Discussion within the Clinton administration on Afghanistan then concentrated on two main alternatives. The first, championed by Rydell and Assistant Secretary of State Carl Inderfirth, was to undertake a major diplomatic effort to end the Afghan civil war and install a national unity government. The second, favored by Sheehan, Clark, and the CIA, called for labeling the Taliban a terrorist group and ultimately funneling secret aid to its chief foe, the Northern Alliance. This dispute would go back and forth throughout 1999 and ultimately become entangled with debate about enlisting the Northern Alliance as an ally for covert action. Another diplomatic option may have been available. Nurturing Afghan exile groups is a possible moderate governing alternative to the Taliban. In late 1999, Washington provided some support for talks among the leaders of exile Afghan groups, including the ousted Rome-based King Zahir Shah and Hamid Karzai, about bolstering anti-Taliban forces inside Afghanistan and linking the Northern Alliance with Pashtun groups. One U.S. diplomat later told us that the exile groups were not ready to move forward and that coordinating fractious groups residing in Bonn, Rome, and Cyprus proved extremely difficult. Frustrated by the Taliban's resistance, two senior State Department officials suggested asking the Saudis to offer the Taliban $250 million for bin Laden. Clark opposed having the United States facilitate a huge grant to a regime as heinous as the Taliban, and suggested that the idea might not seem attractive to either Secretary Albright or First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, both critics of the Taliban's record on women's rights. The proposal seems to have quietly died. Within the State Department, some officials delayed Sheehan and Clark's push either to designate Taliban-controlled Afghanistan as a state sponsor of terrorism, or to designate the regime as a foreign terrorist organization, thereby avoiding the issue of whether to recognize the Taliban as Afghanistan's government. Sheehan and Clark prevailed in July 1999 when President Clinton issued an executive order, effectively declaring the Taliban regime a state sponsor of terrorism. In October, a UN Security Council resolution championed by the United States added economic and travel sanctions. With UN sanctions set to come into effect in November, Clark wrote Berger that the Taliban appeared to be up to something. Mullah Omar had shuffled his cabinet and hinted at bin Laden's possible departure. Clark's staff thought his most likely destination would be Somalia. Chechnya seemed less appealing with Russia on the offensive. Clark commented that Iraq and Libya had previously discussed hosting bin Laden, though he and his staff had their doubts that bin Laden would trust secular Arab dictators, such as Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi. Clark also raised the remote possibility of Yemen, which offered vast, uncontrolled spaces. In November, the CSG discussed whether the sanctions had rattled the Taliban, who seemed to be looking for a face-saving way out of the bin Laden issue. In fact, none of the outside pressure had any visible effect on Mullah Omar, who was unconcerned about commerce with the outside world. Omar had virtually no diplomatic contact with the West, since he refused to meet with non-Muslims. The United States learned that at the end of 1999, the Taliban Council of Ministers unanimously reaffirmed that their regime would stick by bin Laden. Relations between bin Laden and the Taliban leadership were sometimes tense, but the foundation was deep and personal. Indeed, Mullah Omar had executed at least one subordinate who opposed his pro-bin Laden policy. The United States would try tougher sanctions in 2000, working with Russia, a country involved in an ongoing campaign against Chechen separatists, some of whom received support from bin Laden. The United States persuaded the United Nations to adopt Security Council Resolution 1333, which included an embargo on arms shipments to the Taliban in December 2000. The aim of the resolution was to hit the Taliban where it was most sensitive, on the battlefield against the Northern Alliance, and criminalize giving them arms and providing military advisors, which Pakistan had been doing. Yet the passage of the resolution had no visible effect on Omar, nor did it halt the flow of Pakistani military assistance to the Taliban. U.S. authorities had continued to try to get cooperation from Pakistan in pressing the Taliban to stop sheltering bin Laden. President Clinton contacted Sharif again in June 1999, partly to discuss the crisis with India, but also to urge Sharif, in the strongest way I can, to persuade the Taliban to expel bin Laden. The president suggested that Pakistan use its control over oil supplies to the Taliban and over Afghan imports through Karachi. Sharif suggested that instead, Pakistani forces might try to capture bin Laden themselves. Though no one in Washington thought this was likely to happen, President Clinton gave the idea his blessing. The president met with Sharif in Washington in early July. Though the meeting's main purpose was to seal the Pakistani prime minister's decision to withdraw from the Kargil confrontation in Kashmir, President Clinton complained about Pakistan's failure to take effective action with respect to the Taliban and bin Laden. Sharif came back to his earlier proposal and